This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for Joshua Johnson in Washington. For generations, men and women were fed the old saying, sugar and spice and everything nice, that's what little girls are made of. Really?
That's what you're telling me right now. Look at me when I'm talking to you. You're telling me that my assault doesn't matter. That what happened to me doesn't matter.
Women across America are angry. They're taking that anger to the streets and going further. We know record numbers of women this year are running for state and federal office. And there's a lot to be mad about. Wage gaps, sexual harassment and violence, condescension, mockery. And unlike men, women know there are risks to publicly expressing your anger or dissatisfaction with the status quo. Today, we see you, we hear you, and we want to hear from you. Here's some of what you've already shared with us.
My name is Cindy Lane.
My name is Dimitri Adrenning.
Hi, this is Julie from Louisville, Kentucky. I am in my mid-60s, and my entire life I've been told to act like a lady.
When I was growing up, I was always taught that, you know, not to lose your cool, not to lose your temper.
My mother taught me never to be angry, always to be nice.
Demure, sitting in the back, not making a lot of noise.
It taught me not to really deal with my emotions, and it kind of pushed me to leave my anger and internalize it.
Today, as an adult, I still struggle with expressing my anger, and I cry.
I just think that there's a huge disparity between men's feelings and women's feelings.
We want to hear from you as we spend this hour looking at women's rage and anger in politics, at work, and in the culture. And we're lucky to have some fantastic guests to help us discuss women's rage and anger in America today. Three prominent writers out with new books on this very topic. Here with me in studio is Rebecca Traister, writer at large for New York Magazine and The Cut. She's out with a brand new book, Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. She's also author of the 2016 book, All the Single Ladies, Unmarried Women and the Rise of an Independent Nation. Rebecca Traister, it's great to have you.
It's wonderful to be here.
Thank you for being here. And from an NPR studio in New York is Soraya Shamali. She's director of the Women's Media Center Speech Project. She's author of the new book, Rage Becomes Her, The Power of Women's Anger. Hello, Soraya.
Hi, Todd.
And joining from Piscataway, New Jersey is Brittany Cooper. Brittany Cooper is Associate Professor of Women's and Gender Studies and Africana Studies at Rutgers University. She is out with a new book, Eloquent Rage, A Black Feminist Discovers Her Superpower. Brittany Cooper, great to have you on 1A.
Thanks, Todd.
Women's anger and rage has become the focus of the last several weeks in this country with Christine Blasey Ford's testimony in the Senate, in the Judiciary Committee, Judge Brett Kavanaugh's response, and the way that women and men have reacted to that testimony. Let's just take a moment to set it up. Rebecca Traister, you've watched these moments along with the rest of us in America. What have you seen these last couple of weeks?
Well, there was partly what we saw in the hearing room itself, which was Christine Blasey Ford presenting her story within the narrow, very narrow range of expressive acceptability that women know they have to fall between if they're going to be heard and taken seriously and not written off as hysterical or unhinged. So she was not angry, though the story she told was a story of trauma, not only the assault she described, but becoming a public figure and the reaction to her and her family since she's become a public figure. But she didn't raise her voice. She didn't yell. She didn't express fury. In fact, she was sort of consummately polite, solicitous. She kept saying, I just want to be collegial. She made jokes. She smiled. And her testimony was very compelling, in part because she stayed within these sort of broadly understood boundaries for how women's voices are to be heard if we want them to be taken seriously and not written off. Then Brett Kavanaugh came in, and he had an entirely different set of tools in his arsenal. He could use anger in a way that would have disqualified Christine Blasey Ford. He could use it to emphasize the seriousness of his plight, what he was presenting as the way in which he had been injured in this process, in which damage, unjust damage had been done to him. And he yelled and fumed and was disrespectful to the senators and talked back to them and turned their questions on them. He was incredibly aggressive. And it wasn't simply that she wasn't permitted to use anger and he was. It was that that anger could work for him to help his case. He could use it on his own behalf. Whereas had Christine Blasey Ford turn to anger, it might well have worked against her.
Saraya, that's the picture from inside the hearing room we all watched on our television. Some people were there live. What about outside the hearing room? What did you see ripple through the culture, through the Senate, through the country after Brett Kavanaugh's testimony, after Christine Blasey Ford's testimony?
Well, there were several things. One was that the stark difference in their behavior resonated, I think, with women everywhere. It was so clear that part of her ability to be believable and to retain whatever credibility she could came with her having to be deferential in the way that Rebecca describes. And I think women understand that. And so seeing it was enraging, actually, because the difference was huge. I think, too, though, that the starkness of it maybe surprised certain people who aren't necessarily thinking about the tightrope that women walk every day. They do this in their own homes. They do this in the professional workplace. And to see it enacted in the way that it was as such a visceral call to power on his part was enraging, and I think for many people traumatic. And you could see that ripple through media. You could see it in conversations on the street. It was just very evident in ways that sometimes you can describe in words but don't have the same effect.
Brittany Cooper, what did you see?
So what I saw was white men sort of running a victory lap at the expense of a vulnerable woman. And I saw these expressions of gender that are so interesting to watch as a Black person who grew up and who was a little girl during the Anita Hill hearings, thinking about the ways that Anita Hill could not who she ended up in a similar position to Christine Blasey Ford, in that the senators who listened to her did not find her testimony particularly compelling, but she was not allowed to be vulnerable, not allowed to cry, not allowed to show even the range of emotion that we saw Christine Blasey Ford being able to show. And so I found myself and my colleagues who are working at the intersections of both racial justice and gender justice having to think about, what does it mean to be in solidarity with Christine Blasey Ford in this moment as feminists? One, because I believe her, and I believe women when they say that they have been sexually assaulted. And I was left with the distinct impression that even the men who listened to her, whatever their political leanings, also believed her, but that they had made a negotiation that her truth didn't matter if it was going to in any way diminish their sort of brazen bid for power. And that is infuriating because it means that there is no integrity. It means that there are no lines anymore. It means that there are no standards that hold us, that we can hold ourselves to in this political moment, that we're in a sort of crass power grab. And what I know as a Black person and a Black woman in this moment is that if white women cannot compel the sort of humanity of white men in power to do the right thing, then that says something about the vulnerability of every population, not just white women, but in particular people of color and women of color. And my levels of fury over that, in addition to my levels of fear, are really off the charts.
Now, this groundswell did not start, of course, with the Kavanaugh hearings. We've seen women's marches bringing out millions of protesting women across the United States from the day after Donald Trump's inauguration. I think you could put a pin in that moment, but even before, in some ways, the fact that a lot of angry women are advocating for change, that it's even a news story, is something. It seems like it's an aberration that women are angry and making their voices heard, but it's not an aberration. And this is one of the themes, Rebecca Traister, that you write about, that women's anger is not always highlighted. It's not always paid attention to. It's not always called that. Sometimes it's sublimated. But that this phenomenon, as remarkable and as new as it seems, isn't new at all.
Well, part of the point is that the people who have the power to tell our stories, whether that means the people who write the history books, the leaders even within certain movements, the news media, the newspapers, have all worked to hide, discourage, or ask us to look away from instances in which women's anger openly expressed has been politically catalytic, has been used as a connective and coalition building tool. And in fact, if you look back at the social and political movements that have transformed the nation, from abolition and suffrage through the labor movement, the civil rights movement, the gay rights movement, and the women's movement of the 1970s, at their start, you will almost always find, if you look really hard past the way that the stories have been told, you will find women who were angry and began to be angry together and work together that have often lit the sparks under those social movements. And one of the crucial things that we've been looking at in advance even of Dr. Blasey Ford's allegations of assault is the power of that protest as it is erupting now during the administration of Donald Trump. You mentioned the women's marches, the protests against the travel ban where so many protesters flooded to airports, the majority of them women, the teacher strikers in states where strikes were illegal. And we saw that even before the allegations of sexual assault, there were protesters in the Senate Judiciary hearings for Kavanaugh protesting about the likelihood that he would overturn Roe v. Wade or gut health care reform. And you heard the way that the powerful men in that room responded. They called them loudmouths and hysterics. There is an anxiety about this openly expressed anger.
We'll get into the ways that women are being penalized for showing this anger and dissuaded from yielding it. That was Rebecca Traister, author and journalist, also talking with Brittany Cooper, associate professor at Rutgers University, and Soraya Shimali, director of the Women's Media Center Speech Project. I'm Todd Willick, sitting in for Joshua Johnson. Glad to be with you. We're going to go out on this segment, by the way, with the song Mad by the singer Solange, featuring Lil Wayne. This is 1A. I'm Todd Willick, sitting in for Joshua Johnson. We're talking about women's anger and taking it seriously with Soraya Shimali, director of the Women's Media Center Speech Project and author of the new book, Rage Becomes Her. Brittany Cooper, associate professor at Rutgers University and author of the new work, Eloquent Rage. And in the studio, Rebecca Traister, writer in New York Magazine and The Cut and author of Good and Mad. We want to hear from you, too. Do you think right now is a moment in U.S. history for women expressing themselves in the form of rage and anger? You can comment on our Facebook page. You can tweet us at 1A. You can always email us 1A@WAMU.org. And we have been hearing from so many of you 1A listeners, primarily women, but not exclusively. Petra emailed to say, I am so tired of people equating my anger with insanity. Friends laugh at my posts and insinuate that I've lost it. And you know what? I have. I have lost my inability to be quiet in the face of gross injustice. And Joan emailed us, I'm 65 and I was in college with the first feminist resurgence. Is the world, the USA, ready for women's anger? That's like asking African Americans, when will the world be ready for their anger? The answer, never. Power doesn't cede without a fight. Don't even ask the question. The question itself is demanding. And Peg in Traverse City emailed this, I'm a conservative woman that is angry that someone could be assumed guilty based on unproven allegations. I'm angry at the assumption that all American women are anti-Kavanaugh, pro-choice, liberal, and progressive. I'm a proud American woman who's also conservative, pro-life, pro-Kavanaugh. I am an American woman too. Now, Rebecca Traister, you started to paint a picture of the history of women who've gotten angry and made their mark. Their anger is not always shown in the same form as somebody yelling in the face of a senator like Jeff Flake on live TV, but anger nonetheless. And Brittany Cooper, you've written a book about finding your power in rage. Tell me a little bit about that theme and how this story fits into the moment.
Sure. So part of what happens is that women are told, as many of your listeners say, that to be angry is to be irrational. And I had a student when I was a graduate instructor confront me and say to me that she loved to listen to me lecture because my lectures were filled with what she called the most eloquent rage ever. And it was a wake-up call for me as someone who had run away from the angry Black woman stereotype my whole life because I didn't want to be discredited as a Black woman moving through predominantly white institutions. And so my student, who was a young Black woman, saw in me a kind of authenticity, and she helped me to realize that my anger wasn't keeping me from doing my job or showing up or offering quality lectures or material, but that it was actually helping me to do a better job. And so in that moment, I made a connection that I've been encouraging other women to make, which is to acknowledge that we have the right to our rage and to reject ideas that say that when we are angry about legitimate injustices, that this in some way makes us irrational or makes our claims illegitimate. And when we then begin to own that anger, it doesn't mean that we become destructive or harmful. It means that we tap into the energy and power, and we start to use that energy and power to build the kind of world we want to see. And more women need to give themselves permission to do that. I've given myself permission to do that. And in this moment, I am on the front lines of saying to women, our rage has the potential, if we own it and if we don't apologize for it, to change this very scary trajectory of this historical moment. We have a lot to be afraid about. We have a lot to be angry about. But that anger is the catalyst for us being able to do something about the things we see.
Now, let's move from the Senate committee hearing room and the hallways around the Senate and even the books that our esteemed authors have written onto the tennis court and the U.S. Open for another moment that Americans shared within the last couple of weeks. Serena Williams in her match against Naomi Osaka at the U.S. Open. Here's a cut. I'll bring you back there to refresh your memory of anger on the court. Serena Williams' infamous exchange with umpire Carlos Ramos.
You owe me an apology. You owe me an apology. I have never cheated in my life. I have a daughter and I stand with her right for her. I've never cheated.
Soraya Shamani, you shared this moment along with the rest of America. Serena is a champion and one of the most famous black women in America, somebody who got angry and somebody who found that anger weaponized against her.
Yes, I think that what we saw in the response was everything that Brittany and Rebecca and I have been talking about. It was interesting because there are so many egregious examples of men behaving in the same way but not facing the same policing or penalties. I mean, she was the fine that was levied against her is the highest ever for verbal abuse in the history of the U.S. Open, I believe. And so in that moment, there were two very distinct responses. There were the responses of the people that really just wanted to see her in isolation acting in this exchange with this man. But then there were people who really looked at that exchange within the much broader context of the power dynamics in the moment and the history and the context and the legacy of discrimination within the sport that she has faced. And so I think that one thing that has been unexplored in the bigger conversation about that is the central and pivotal role of Title IX in understanding women as leaders or as people who have the right to defend themselves or engage in public conflict. What she was really doing was asserting her right to defend herself and to have dignity in the moment, not be accused the way that she was accused. And with sports, I think it's important to note that we now have not one but two generations of women, so a generation of role models who have benefited from Title IX and the lessons of Title IX. We tend to think of it as athletics, but it is really about leadership and the ability to act together in teams, to manage conflict, to make the nuanced distinctions between being assertive and being aggression and being aggressive and being angry. I think we're seeing the efflorescence of that now in our political lives.
Now, there was some pushback, though, to Serena Williams' behavior on the court and the reaction to it, even from within the tennis world. Brittany Cooper, I don't know if you saw Martina Navratilova's response to the Serena Williams episode a couple of days later, but she wrote an op-ed after the U.S. Open, and she said, Martina speaking now, said, Yes, women are treated differently. Yes, there are double standards, but Serena was wrong. Her on-court behavior wasn't appropriate, and I'm paraphrasing, just because men rage at umpires and act like babies on the court doesn't make it right, and a champion like Serena should not emulate it.
Right. Martina Navratilova was wrong. She did this thing that women are conditioned to do, which is rather than use it as a moment of solidarity, she tried to police Serena's conduct. As a lifelong tennis fan, I am livid, but Martina Navratilova reminded me that up until this moment, most white women in tennis have not been allies of the Williams sisters. When I watch tennis with my friends who are African-American tennis fans, we often talk about watching these matches on mute because of the microaggressions that come from white women who are often snarking at the Williams sisters and having things to say. But let me also add that one of the things that was most infuriating about watching the way in which Ramos treated Serena was that there was a broader context to her anger. Not only did he accuse her of cheating, but this also came out on the heels of reports that members of the USTA had been showing up to her house unannounced and testing her over and over again on grounds that maybe she was doping, even though she has come up clean on every drug test, and even though statistics showed that they were testing her double the amount that they were testing any other players on the women's side. And so she had been subjected to repeated indignities. And then, as the best tennis player of her generation and perhaps ever, she then has a referee who accuses her of cheating, and she's won more Grand Slams than any woman other than Margaret Court and any woman in the open era. And that is indicative of the kinds of fury that we're talking about, the ways that women are disrespected daily, have their contributions and their qualifications undermined. And then when they finally explode, the response is your behavior was inappropriate. And what I want to challenge folks to think about is not what happens at the moment of the explosion, but what are all of the moments of disrespect and indignity and injustice that lead to that moment. We have to stop thinking about the products of the provocations that women and Black people encounter, and we have to start thinking about the provocations themselves and the ways that folk in power, particularly men, provoke and provoke and provoke while insisting that the rest of us have to be polite in our response to it. I reject that.
Rebecca Traister, you're nodding.
Yeah, I'm nodding in part because what Brittany is describing and the context that Soraya also referred to in this white-dominated sport, Serena Williams has dominated it and constantly throughout her career of being the greatest of all time, right? It has been suggested that there was something fundamentally illegitimate about her place and her dominance of that sport. And then when she is provoked, she's provoked into displaying anger. And Brittany referred earlier in the conversation to the kind of baggage that is attached to the image and the caricature of an angry Black woman. The language that she used, the thing I was struck by, she was angry, she was upset. In fact, listening to that clip you played of her saying, "I have never cheated in my life," it actually reminded me of Maria Gallagher in that elevator yelling at Jeff Flake, saying, "Look at me, look at me, look at me, don't treat me like a cartoon of what you assume I am," right? It was that same level of a desperate anger to be seen. And she called him a thief. I have heard male tennis players, you know, there's a famous clip of Jimmy Connors in his last run at the U.S. Open, which everybody was thrilled about, having a temper tantrum and calling the ref an abortion. I mean, he literally says, "You're an abortion." I have heard so much worse language. And yet it was she was provoked into what then got cast as some sort of spectacle of rage that became amplified because of all of the associations that have been made around Black women's expression of anger as either cartoonish, inappropriate, dangerous, a threat, and a disruption. And so the provocation that Brittany's describing then produces a scene that isn't even as angry or profane as it might have been, and yet becomes this symbol of disruption that she gets censured for extremely harshly. The whole cycle just reflected so much about the gendered and racial dynamics that are around us all the time and that censure and repress our anger.
I'm Todd Zwillick. You're listening to 1A. So many of you 1A listeners are joining this conversation with our three guests. Catherine in Northern Virginia tweets us, "That's so cute. You think women are just now getting angry and expressing themselves through rage? Maybe it's just finally being recognized." Barbara tweeted us, "You're perpetuating the idea of women as irrational and out of control by using the word rage. We're not raging. We are very reasonably angry and finally feel it's safe enough to say so." And Annalise in North Carolina tweeted us this, "I'm listening to 1A talking about women being hashtag good and mad, but why are the men not furious about kids in cages? Why are men not furious at Donald Trump mocking Christine Blasey Ford? Where are the corporate leaders rioting? Why do women have to be the adults? Y'all are exhausting." That's from Annalise in North Carolina. Let me pull us back down to Brett Kavanaugh and Christine Blasey Ford in the Senate, because it is the push-off point for so much of this conversation in America right now, this provocative moment. The Kavanaugh hearings has brought up a lot of many, many feelings for women and rage at unequal treatment, not being believed, of your pain and experiences, and how different the behavior was between the accuser, Professor Blasey Ford, and the nominee, Brett Kavanaugh. Rebecca Traister, you drew the line between those two performances, if I'll call them that. One listener left us a message with how this hearing made them feel.
My name is Sarah, and I'm calling from Syracuse, New York. I'm a 24-year-old woman, and I think that in my own experience of expressing my anger outwardly, the reactions typically by men have ranged from ridiculing to calling me horrible names, to sexualizing my anger, thinking it's amusing. And I just don't think that that's an experience that men share in any way. I think their anger is taken seriously and seen as just a typical expression of emotion and something that's justified. And I think that I've definitely seen that within the Dr. Ford versus Judge Kavanaugh trial, and that she must behave in a very specific way as a victim. She has to skate this line between showing just enough emotion while containing herself. And Brett Kavanaugh could just really openly express his rage.
I want to add in one other comment from a 1A listener, Brian, who wrote to us on Facebook. "Anger is the emotion that keeps us honest? Really? I thought it was the emotion that leads to assaults and lynchings and a host of other unpleasant activities." Brittany Cooper, the comment from Sarah that we just heard and the comment from Brian makes me want to ask you if men and women might be living in two parallel universes here.
Absolutely. And the universe that men are living in, particularly white men, is a universe of power. And they're in a moment of political power where there is an opportunity to restructure American society again so that it gives men benefits that they do not deserve, that they have not earned, that they do not merit. And I am saying all of those buzzwords because I want to piss men off, because they are trying to create a society that favors white men at the expense of everybody else. And look, power can skew your ability to see and understand reality. And so this is why Black feminist thinkers for centuries have said, you have to listen to the folks who have the least amount of power in society. We are the people who are most connected to reality, who are grounded, and who have an investment in making sure that we tell the truth so that we can reach the most marginalized. And so, yes, men's anger is respected. It is seen as politically important. But I want to be very clear that if we look at violence in this country, it is the violence of angry white men and angry Black men, everybody from a Harvey Weinstein to a Bill Cosby, that puts women in danger. And so we've got to talk about, all anger is not the same. All anger is not equal. All anger is not equal in its ability to do harm. And we have to stop making false equivalencies and saying all anger is bad. If you're powerful and angry and dishonest about your anger, then you are dangerous to the rest of us. If your anger comes from an honest and righteous place, we need to listen to more of that. This is why we need to listen to women. That's why we need to follow women politically, particularly women who are left-leaning, not conservative women who are still drinking the Kool-Aid and thinking that allying with powerful men is going to save them. Christine Blasey Ford is a cautionary tale of what happens when you think that you can vote for conservative men and that women will be safe. It is simply not the case.
That's Brittany Cooper. We're going to hear a lot more from our other guests and a lot more from you too. Here's an email from Karen who says, "In this moment, I noticed that no one is talking about Hillary Clinton and her loss in 2016. 16, I was so angry at her loss. I felt totally repudiated as a woman and as a woman of my dad and of my and her generation. It was so clear that the constraints on Hillary as she waged that campaign and the misogyny that helped defeat her. Well, Karen, take heart, because we will talk a little bit about Hillary Clinton at the very top of the next segment. We have much more to come on how many women just aren't seething with their anger, but using it to run for office in the next election. We're going to go out of this segment with the song Anonymous by Slater Kinney. We'll be back in a minute here on 1A. As they say, stay close. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for Joshua Johnson. We're talking about the power of women's anger in the current moment in America. I'm talking with Rebecca Traister for New York Magazine and The Cut, author of Good and Mad. Brittany Cooper, associate professor at Rutgers University and author of the new book, Eloquent Rage. And also Soraya Shamali, director of the Women's Media Center Speech Project and author of the new book, Rage Becomes Her. Now, I read an email from Karen at the end of the last segment that said she was hurt, disappointed, and angry, wounded about the treatment of Hillary Clinton in the 2016 campaign. And I want to go there because Hillary Clinton is one prominent, famous woman, well known for navigating the shoals of how women are supposed to express themselves in public. Now, Hillary Clinton has a history of being very careful and very deliberate, mindful of appearing angry or emotional. She's been at it for 35 years in America. And in fact, it was news in the 2008 campaign. I remember this when she shed a tear in New Hampshire, one tear, and it was at the top of CNN for like a news cycle and a half. So now a lot of people are saying that the 2016 presidential campaign, Hillary Clinton, in fact, was tone policed. Listen.
I regret deeply how angry the tone of the campaign became.
Not your fault.
Not your fault, says one audience member when Hillary Clinton very deliberately and that in Hillary fashion says, I regret how nasty the campaign became. Soraya Shamali, this moment has clearly struck a chord with Rebecca Traister, who's laughing here in the studio with me. But how does that strike you?
Well, she was also, she was very, very careful in her choice of words there, too, even as she was commenting on it. I mean, I think it was ridiculous that this woman was called inauthentic while being held to this standard of careful control in her voice and her facial appearance and her body and her mode of expression. I mean, the two candidates that were her primary opponents, both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, could act in unhinged ways. They could show up looking unkempt. They could pound podiums. You know, they could turn red in the face. And as men, they could leverage this enormous tide of populist anger. And that was a gender card. Nobody wrote about that as a gender card, right? There were all of these conversations about Hillary Clinton, as there often are with women, because we associate gender with women and pretend men don't have a gender. And so they could do that, and she couldn't leverage that political power. And Rebecca, we saw that over and over and over again throughout the campaign.
Rebecca, go ahead.
Soraya is so right about this. And in fact, the irony of what we were told about Hillary Clinton, both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump were congratulated by the political press for their particular skill in channeling the anger of their supporters. This was their gift. They were able to give voice to this frustration. And we were repeatedly told that some of the inauthenticity of Hillary was that she couldn't convey anger and passion. And yet, every time she spoke too close to a microphone, somebody said, you're yelling, you're shrill. She really got directives. At one point, Joe Scarborough, she was giving a speech the night she won a primary, and Joe Scarborough said, smile, as if it was like some catcaller on the street, smile more. She was told that regularly. And I think that that's, again, an example of not having that tool to wield. She also has done remarkable writing and talking herself, in instances where I've interviewed her, and she's written about it in her own memoir of the campaign, about the process of not using that anger. She writes particularly about that second debate where Donald Trump came up behind her and kind of loomed behind her, and how menacing and aggressive his body language was, and how during the debate, a presidential debate, she was doing internal calculations thinking, can I turn around and confront this guy? She said she thought about turning around and saying, get away from me, but that she was thinking, No, that's going to redound negatively to me. That's going to make me look bad. It's going to hurt me strategically in the debate. And so she didn't. And one of the things that that little story tells us is about how much energy women expend modulating, considering, strategizing, thinking tactically about how to use their voice, how to suppress their voice, how to channel their anger, how to swallow their anger, what to do in order to be rhetorically effective. And I think that that's something that all three of us are writing about and thinking about, is the amount of time and energy women spend doing this kind of maneuvering around the rules around our angry expression.
Now, I want to talk a little bit in the last sort of section of the show that we have about where some of this anger goes, because this is a moment in America, and let's be realistic, moments have a way of fading. They just do. And so I'm interested in where this goes when maybe the cameras and all of the writers who aren't Rebecca Traister and Brittany Cooper are not as interested anymore, you know, in a couple of years. I think that might happen, and I want to know where this goes. Now, we've been hearing from so many 1A listeners. I want to play you another mashup of some of the women's voices who've been reaching out to us about how they're feeling.
My name's Erin. I'm calling from Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
This is Sarah from Cincinnati.
When I let my anger bubble over and I get really angry out loud, it really doesn't do much good.
I find that if I express a strong opinion or even just a bit of discomfort with something, I'm perceived as being angry or overreacting.
Women yelling, even in this day and age, is not very acceptable.
Men don't seem to have that same problem, and starting to feel like maybe it's not just a personal issue I'm dealing with.
We're supposed to be nice and keep our mouths shut. However, I am so angry. I'm so angry right now.
Maybe women all over the place are dealing with it.
I'm turning my anger into action.
Guess it helps to feel like I'm not alone, but still pretty discouraging.
I think that's what women have to do. We have to take that anger, hold on to it, and that's how we're going to take back this country.
We're hearing from 1A listeners, women who it feels like there's a theme there, are transferring some of their personal rage. I'm sure a lot of it's in personal life, not just political life or cultural life, but into action, taking action in the streets, taking action maybe at the ballot box. We got this tweet from Tracy in Jacksonville. I'm one of the thousands of women using their frustration to run for office. I'm running for the Florida House District 15. I am focused on my determination to be a voice for all and a focus on issues important to Jacksonville families. Tracy is one candidate who says that this moment of anger is very important for her motivation. Brittany Cooper, I want to talk about where this goes in terms of maybe the midterms. That might be the most immediate effect. None of us knows exactly how that vote is going to turn out, but it seems like any pollster or political analyst worth anything is looking down in what they call the crosstabs and noticing that women are mad, women are going to vote, and women are going to form a tidal wave in 2018 one way or the other.
Absolutely. And that is as it should be. I'm particularly heartened by the Stacey Abrams campaign down in Georgia. We have the opportunity to have the first Black woman governor of a state, of a former slave state, the Ayanna Pressley campaign. There are all of these progressive campaigns that are being run. And here's the thing. We've been seeing that since 2016. We had a wave of progressive, sort of radically progressive Black mayors in the Deep South. And so one of the things that I want to challenge folks to do as we think in this moment is to actually look at what people of color are doing, not just women, but particularly Black women in these elections, the ways that we have been channeling our anger for decades and decades. And that started with the way that we voted for Hillary Clinton in this most immediate political moment. But to your earlier point about whether or not our anger can be sustained, I think that I think that this can be sustained. I think that we have to remember that the women's movement in this country, though it goes through ebbs and flows, has really been a solid political project since, depending on how you count, 1831 or 1848. So we're 200 years in almost here. And so I think, you know, I think that there's a real opportunity for us to make some change here. And I think that as women see that our power and our ability to frame issues in ways that include the most Americans and take care of the most marginalized Americans, I'm excited about a blue wave. What I hope, though, is that folks start to see that even if you don't care a lot about presidential politics, that down ballot races really matter, that local races really matter. And I think that we're going to do something a bit different than even 1992, which was declared the year of the woman. And as Rebecca has pointed out over and over again, it only meant that we got four women into the Senate. It wasn't huge by any stretch. So we, you know, we are very impressed with ourselves when we haven't done very much. And so I'm hoping that this time around, our enthusiasm for ourselves is actually warranted in the numbers and in the wins that we see in November.
Now, Soraya, what about conservative women, though? And I realize you aren't one, but certainly an astute political observer, because, look, there are millions and millions of women across this country who share the opinion of the one emailer that I read,
yes,
who said, I'm not down with convicting Brett Kavanaugh. I'm not down with all of this rage. I get the critique that they benefit from this patriarchy. I totally get it. And yet, look, I've watched the polls since Brett Kavanaugh's performance. His rating among Republican women hasn't gotten worse. It's gotten better by about 4 points. He is more positively rated now than he was by women on the Republican side.
Well, I think we saw this in the transition of sort of a national anger. So before the election, according to a couple of different surveys, the angriest people in the country were conservative white women. After the election, they kind of passed the baton to liberal women, mainly liberal white women. And so that shift, I think, is meaningful in that kind of activism that we're seeing. But the caller that described herself essentially is prototypical of a person who has very systems justifying beliefs and a sense that the world is just and that if you do something wrong, you deserve whatever happens to you. And that if something bad happens to you, you must have done something wrong. And so that worldview is extremely it's extremely tied to often deeply religious, so usually white evangelical or white Christian and Catholic communities that have very sex segregated roles, that have responsibilities that accrue to men and women differently, and that in theory are complementary and equal, but are really hierarchical. And in those systems, women experience real inequality. And so the white women, 53% of whom voted for Trump, who maybe many of them are supporting Kavanaugh, can leverage their racial status to offset their lack of gender status. And I think we see that over and over and over again in our history and still today. But I think one notable aspect...
Soraya, forgive me for interrupting you, but this is the tyranny of the clock
of
in the radio business. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. The tyranny is gone. Soraya, go right ahead.
there was just one last thing, which is that around the world and in the United States, too, authoritarian beliefs tend to be embraced first and most readily by women in situations of great gender inequality. And we never really want to talk about what gender inequality looks like in conservative white families. But I think that that is central to understanding that sense of justifying the system as it is, because you experience power vicariously and you depend on a strong man, for example, to provide and protect. And Kavanaugh performed that way, right? He was indignant and he was very muscular and petulant, but sort of hyper-masculine in his anger.
Now, Brittany talked about where she thinks this movement might go when the cameras are gone. Donald Trump is not going to be president forever, and political winds do shift. But before we end the hour, I want to go back to the immediate term, Rebecca Tracer. It can't be ignored, and I think we should just spend a minute here, that the resolution of this furor over Brett Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court rests largely, and in the end might rest entirely, on two women senators. They look at the evidence, you know, senators are going to look at the FBI report, they'll look at party, they'll look at Mitch McConnell, what do I need to do? They'll look at politics, they'll look at the election, all of that. But I have a really hard time imagining, even after years in this business, in politics, that these two women senators at this moment will want to repudiate or put themselves in a position of being perceived to be repudiating women's anger and women's voices and this moment in America. Because
you have a hard time believing that they're...
I guess maybe I want to have a hard time believing that because this nomination has become so much bigger than Brett Kavanaugh, right? It's about... there is a moment in this country and everybody's aware of it. And this could rest on the shoulders, possibly, of two women senators now.
It could. There's also, it's become about so much more than Brett Kavanaugh from the perspective of the angry women and from the perspective of conservative politics in this country, so that it's now about a win, and that for a lot of a Donald Trump Republican Party, this is about getting this guy through and also making some statements about what they will not put up with. They will not put up with having a further accrual of power on the right of a white patriarchy disrupted by the stories and the anger of women. They don't want this to be a model for how people with less power might interfere with the further accrual of power by those who already have a lot of power. So there's a lot on the line, and I actually don't know what's going to happen. Every day so far from the past month has brought surprises. I don't want to make predictions, but I will say this. I'm not going to be surprised if Brett Kavanaugh is confirmed to the court. And you know what? If he's not, there's going to be another judge who's going to be confirmed to do the same work that the Republicans want Brett Kavanaugh to do, which is put into place mechanisms that are going to suppress the angry resistance of the masses, including women. And that includes taking away voting rights, collective bargaining rights, reproductive rights. This is also a long-term fight. The mass anger extends decades into our future, regardless of the immediate result. We saw that with Clarence Thomas. Anita Hill has reverberated for 27 years in electoral politics and in protest and in awareness of sexual harassment. We are looking at wins that are deep into the future, even if we have losses that are short term.
That is the voice of Rebecca Traister, writer for New York Magazine and The Cut, author of Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. Rebecca Traister, what a pleasure. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Also, Brittany Cooper, associate professor at Rutgers University and author of the new book, Eloquent Rage, A Black Feminist Discovers Her Superpower. Brittany Cooper, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Soraya Shamali, director of the Women's Media Center Speech Project and author of the new book, Rage Becomes Her, The Power of Women's Anger. Soraya Shamali, thanks to you.
Thanks very much, Todd.
I'd like everyone to remember that you can subscribe to 1A's podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you like. We'd love it if you would write us a review. If you're new to podcasts, you can find all the links to listen online at npr.org/1A. This hour was produced by Bianca Martin. To learn more about her and the rest of our team, visit the website at the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Todd Zwillick. Sitting in for Joshua Johnson, we're going to end the show today with Bay. Here's Beyonce. Thanks so much for listening. It's 1A.